From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
The beloved wildflowers of springtime, the trilliums, the mayapples, the Virginia bluebells, are probably gone till next year. But don't despair, because here comes the next cast of players, the wildflowers of summer. The acclaimed naturalist Carol Gracie looks beyond their surface beauty in her new book on the subject, into their life histories and even cultural uses of plants like cardinal flower, lupin, milkweed, asters, goldenrods, and more. We'll talk about some of her favorites today, but first these messages.
Programming and underwriting support from Brushwood Nursery. For more than 20 years, Brushwood Nursery has shipped the finest selection of clematis and other vines all over the United States with full gallon-sized plant and free shipping. Their website is full of beautiful pictures and information on growing clematis. Brushwoodnursery.com. Programming and underwriting support from Garden Tool Company. Garden Tool Company's wide selection of heirloom quality tools for your gardening passion is backed by outstanding customer service, fast shipping, and ongoing support. GardenToolCompany.com.
Carol Gracie, a former longtime educator at the New York Botanical Garden, who also worked for the Nature Conservancy, has followed her own intense curiosity to become a leading expert on wildflowers. Now her second book, Summer Wildflowers of the Northeast, A Natural History, from Princeton University Press, forms the companion to her earlier spring volume. Welcome back to the show, Carol.
Thanks, Margaret. It's nice to be back on your show.
Yeah. I should say before we get started that we'll have a book giveaway with the transcript of the show over on awaytogarden.com for listeners can come and for a chance to win the book, which I've been enjoying very much, so thank you.
Thank you.
Yes. So I want to start with the same question I asked you when we spoke, I don't know, a few years back upon the publication of your book, Spring Wildflowers of the Northeast. The subhead on the cover of the new book, the summer book, as on the old one, says A Natural History. And I'd like to know what that means. Tell people what that means.
Well, it means looking beyond just the beauty of the flowers and learning about how they fit into the environment.
Yes.
And what their importance is to insects or birds or other animals, and sometimes to other plants as well. So yeah. I like people to know how these plants work in the environment, what their roles are.
You encourage us, I think, in the text, in the preface of the book, you encourage us when we're looking at wildflowers to almost act as a birder does when watching birds, yeah?
Yeah, I do, because it's not just checking off that you've seen a Canada lily, for example, or you've seen a house sparrow. It's really observing what that organism is doing, and there are still things to be learned about, even our local wildflowers, that have not been observed, because people just think, well, they're common, they've been here forever. Anything that is known about them must be written already. But yet, if you just take the time and patience to sit there and watch, you could discover something new.
Mm.
And you'll definitely discover something interesting.
Your book in the title, and it zeroes in on the Northeast, but we should say where that is, because it's not a small area, the Northeast, in the terms of this
right.
book.
Right. Thank you for doing that. I'm using the concept that was used in Gleason and Cronquist, which is the Manual for Vascular Plants of the Northeast. And his concept of the Northeast goes from southern Canada down along more or less the Mississippi River down to northern Missouri and across into Kentucky and Virginia. So it's a big area. I've had people say, oh, I'm from Virginia. I'm sorry, I can't buy that book because it doesn't have any of my plants in. But these plants are often wide-ranging, and many of them are in the Midwest and in the northern part of the South as well.
Right. So, for example, one that's in the book, and I don't know how you managed to choose, I mean, because there's a lot of plants out there in that regional area that are bloom in the summer from early to late. But you picked, how many are there in the book? Are there 30 or how many are there?
There are more. There are about 35, I think, even more than that, because in some chapters I cover many more than one species, group of related species, for instance.
Right. So, for instance, you chose common milkweed, and there are other milkweeds, but you chose common milkweed. And that is over a far wider range than what we just talked about.
Right. And that goes even beyond the Northeast. So
yeah,
it's an important plant for many reasons, and I'm sure all of your listeners are familiar with the milkweed monarch story, but it has many other interactions with other insects in particular.
Right.
That make it fascinating to me.
So let's talk a little bit about that. The species is, so it's Asclepias.
Asclepias syriaca, which may sound surprising because it indicates that it comes from Syria. But in fact, that goes back to a mistake that was made back in the 1600s when this plant was first brought back to European botanists to describe. And they saw it as being the same as a plant that had been discovered in Syria. And thus they lumped it into that same species, which was a Opossum syriacum. Mm-hmm. And when Linnaeus realized that it was a different genus, that it was far different from Opossum, he put it into a different genus, Asclepias, but by the rules of botanical nomenclature, he had to keep the second part of the name, the specific epithet. So thus, it carries on that syriaca in its name.
Huh.
So it's a bit confusing, but it's all very legal botanically.
So once you get your adjective, you keep your adjective, so to speak.
Yes, right? I do. Right.
Yeah. You just said it, and we all say, even uninitiated non-gardeners and non-botanists, you say milkweed, people think monarch. But as you say in the book, it's actually a guild of insects. You refer to it as a guild of insects who appreciate this plant in one way or another. So I thought it'd be just kind of fun to introduce us to some of who you've met in getting to know milkweed, common milkweed, better.
Well, first of all, there is this large guild of insects. It must be a dozen or more different insects that feed upon milkweed in one way or another. And they include not just butterflies and moths, but also beetles and bugs and aphids and what else? Weevils. Well, weevil is a kind of beetle. But they don't compete with each other. You would think with all of those things feeding on the same plant, there would be a lot of competition. And the reason for that is they either feed at a different time of year or they feed on a different part of the plant. Some of them feed on roots as larvae. Some of them feed on the leaves as adults. And others lay their eggs in the stems. So there are many, many different ways of predating milkweed. And I think the most fascinating to me is probably the four-eyed milkweed beetle. Because if you look at it closely, which I tend to do when I'm taking my photographs, it looks as though it has four eyes. And that's because it's a member of the long-horned beetle group. And those long horns refer to the antennae that they have, which are proportionately long for the size of the insect. And those antennae are placed on the head so that the eye has a little notch in it that sort of surround the antennae. But in the case of the four-eyed milkweed beetle, it's so far in that the eye is split in two. So you actually have an eye above the antenna and an eye below the antenna on each side.
Oh, my.
So it's a strange-looking creature. And all of these insects, almost all of them, have similar what we call warning colors or aposematic colors that warn predators like birds, for instance, or other insects that they might be toxic. Just like the monarch has that bright, its caterpillar has yellow and black and white, and its adult has the orange and black pattern on its wings. And most of these other insects that feed on milkweed are also colored similarly. And they are colored that way because it warns birds, before they try to eat them that, hey, think twice, I may be toxic. It's a system that's developed over eons that eventually protects most of the insects. There's always a learning experience for the bird. You know, it may try one monarch and get very sick and learn then not to try others. But the milkweed beetle, for instance, is red and black. The sort of round leaf beetle that feeds on milkweed is also sort of an orangey red and black. There are two different species of milkweed bugs that are red and black. So there's kind of a theme that carries through, with the weevil being the exception. That's a dull gray, and its protection is just to quickly drop to the ground if something comes after it.
Hmm. Yeah, bees have warning coloration. I mean, probably the most familiar insects, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's
the contrast,
the black against
yellow.
A bright color.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. You might take a bite once, but you probably won't again.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
So some must die to protect the rest. But and in fact, milkweed has a variety of percentage of those cardiac glycosides in its sap. So some of them are really not toxic at all. They say maybe 2/3 of them are toxic enough to cause a bird that feeds on a caterpillar or a butterfly to become ill. And the other third is sort of a mimic in a way, in that it doesn't have enough toxic cardiac glycosides in to become harmful to birds, but it's protected because it looks just like the other milkweeds.
Mm. Sometimes I see a lot of this plant, a lot of this plant. It's a plant that is a robust grower.
Oh, unfortunately it is. I speak from experience. Like everybody else, I've been doing my best to help monarchs, and they're telling everybody, plant milkweeds. But I have a small perennial garden, and my milkweed, which I planted from seed, did well the first year or so, but then by the third year, it had traveled under my stone pathway and come up in an entirely different part of the garden and was spreading all over. And it took an awful lot of work to dig it out because it spreads primarily by underground rhizomes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like tuberous, and you have to get every bit out, otherwise any piece that you left will grow into a new milkweed plant. So I still have an occasional one coming up here and there, but for the most part, it's gone.
Yeah, it's a good one to give a space of its own to, I think, like some of the goldenrods that we can talk about later, and many plants, that they're more inclined to a wide open space than toward having neighbors in a tightly planned perennial border, or the sort of contrivance of a garden. Sometimes it's hard to confine them to those spaces, I think. So one of the most curious plants among those you included in the book is the Indian pipe. And it's this little creature that's white, doesn't have any chlorophyll, I guess, right? And I remember the first time I ever saw one in the woods in New Hampshire as a little girl, where we went for summers. And I thought, what is that white thing under the tree? tell us about the Indian pipe, because it was surprised to me that it was in here. Even being a plant person, I think of it as sort of this otherworldly creature.
Right. Well, I've been with many friends who are pretty knowledgeable about wildflowers, who upon seeing Indian pipe for the first time thought that it must be some sort of strange fungus.
Yeah.
But it's not. It's a true flowering plant. As you mentioned, it doesn't have chlorophyll, so it can't photosynthesize. It has no green pigment to capture the sun's energy. And because of that, you often find it in the dark understory of a forest because it doesn't need the sunlight. So it's sort of ghostly. In fact, another name for it is corpse flower, but I prefer Indian pipe.
Yeah.
But it's It has all the floral parts. If you bend that pipe up and look under it, you can see stamens and a big, wide stigma that takes up most of the space in the opening of the flower. And it's got the petals, which form sort of a tubular-like structure, and sepals, and it even has little tiny scale-like leaves on the stems. But, of course, they don't function the way normal green leaves do.
Right.
So because it can't photosynthesize and make its own food, it has to get its nutrients from someplace else. And this is one of those plants that we now refer to as mycoheterotrophs, which is a very fancy name for a plant that depends upon a fungus as an intermediary between itself and another green photosynthetic plant. In the case of Indian pipe, it's trees. Mm-hmm. And the fungus, in this case, is known. In most cases, they don't know what the fungus is because they don't often find the fruiting body of it. It's just the underground mycelia, they're called, that thread through the soil and connect one plant to another. But it's a member of the Russula group. It can be either the genus Russula or the genus Lactarius, which are both very common mushrooms.
Yes.
Some of them are really quite pretty. The Russula that I photographed for the book growing next to the Indian pipe is a bright red cap. It's a gilled fungus. So it's a very interesting combination because from the root mass of the Indian pipe, it's infiltrated by the fungus, which then, again, infiltrates the root hairs of a nearby tree. So it brings photosynthate, carbohydrates, from the tree to the Indian pipe so that it can survive. And it also provides the tree with extra surface. The root hairs have a greater ability to pick up minerals from the soil, like phosphorus, for instance.
Mm.
So it's not... It's not really helping the fungus at all. The fungus is, I think, not really getting anything from this interaction. I may be wrong on that, but it helps the tree and it helps the Indian pipe.
So is that saprophyte? Is that what you call that kind of relationship, a saprophyte?
Well, that's what you and I probably first learned when we were learning about plants. They were called saprophytes back in the Dark Ages.
Oh, and, when we were 29?
Right. I know you're younger than I, but up until not too long ago, these were thought to be saprophytes, which meant a plant that derived its nutrients from the decomposition of material in the soil, organic material like leaf litter and that sort of thing. And it was only more recently that they discovered, no, it's really this relationship with a fungus. It's called a mycorrhizal fungus because it grows on the roots.
Okay.
And it's not just with plants that are achlorophyllous or have no chlorophyll like Indian pipe, but with many, many other plants too, especially others in the blueberry family, I might add, which Indian pipe is a member of.
Oh, interesting. Oh,
mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, I saw another oddball the other day when I took a walk, just a short digression, and I keyed it out. It was just a strange thing, sort of orangey and yellow. Almost, at first, the flower had looked almost like a bee balm kind of a thing, but it wasn't. And, it was a pedicularis. You know what I'm talking about, pedicularis canadensis. And when I looked it up, I read it was a hemiparasite. Speaking of life cycles and life histories of plants and how they live, a hemiparasite.
Well, that just means that it does have chlorophyll in its leaves. You probably notice that it has normal green leaves.
Yeah.
So it is capable of making its own carbohydrates, but it has very few root hairs on its roots. So it needs that relationship with something else. It parasitizes up to 80 different or over 80 different species. It's not very specific. Some parasites are host specific and will only parasitize one particular plant. But Pedicularis canadensis, which is sometimes referred to as louse wort or wood betony, will parasitize many different plants and get its water and minerals from that source.
Huh.
So it can make its own carbohydrates, but it needs extra water and minerals coming from another plant.
Okay. All right. I loved in the book that you included jewelweed, a native impatiens, impatiens capensis. And I always leave a few patches it self sows around the garden, and I always leave a few areas despite the suffix weed in its common name. And I read in your book that the seedlings germinate synchronously in spring. And I just noticed that outside recently. So they literally like all come awake at the same moment and the same size.
They do. And yeah, they just cover vast areas of usually sort of low, wet ground.
Uh-huh.
And therefore, they outcompete anything else that may be coming up at the same time because of the shade that they produce.
Yeah.
And not all of them survive, otherwise you would have a tangled mess of plants. But those that are the fittest will survive, and you'll have a nice clump of jewelweed there.
Yeah. What a genius.
Which I always used to enjoy when I taught children because they loved popping the fruits and having the seeds shot out. But I find that adults like it just as much. So
it's
a fun plant to talk about when I do field walks for adults as well.
Yeah.
Those seeds are edible as well. They're I compare them a little bit to black walnuts in taste.
Oh.
But, of course, it takes a handful to make it worth eating.
Uh-huh.
So you have to hold the fruit carefully in your hand and capture the seeds in your hand, so that they don't go shooting off a few feet away. And then you can eat them.
Huh.
And they're one of the most beautiful seeds because if you peel off the outer brown seed coat, they're an absolutely beautiful turquoise blue, or robin's egg blue, perhaps.
Huh. I saw the picture in the book, and I'd never seen them that color, so that this year I'm going to have to try to grab some before they fly around and before they go boing.
Yeah, you just peel off or scrape off with your fingernail that outer covering.
Yeah. So we have, you know, maybe 3 minutes, just a couple minutes left, and I just, you know, what are maybe the most familiar, I think of them as sort of late summer wildflowers of all, the goldenrods and the asters. With both of those, and you have a lot about them in the book, but I have to confess I get overwhelmed. And, you know, to me, like the goldenrods, it's like sparrows. You know, I know it's a sparrow or a goldenrod, but I'm not sure which one. And same with the asters.
Right.
It made me smile, not really, that there's no longer technically any member of the genus Aster in northeastern North America, right? They've all been renamed.
That's true. In fact, the names are actually the old names that they had a long time ago before they were lumped into the genus Aster. There are asters in Europe in particular and in other parts of the world, but all of those in our country have been segregated off from very detailed botanical characters into one genus or another. Sometimes it's dependent on the shape of the bracts, or the involucral bracts, I should say, under the flower head, or the type of hairs, or a lot of very minor characteristics. So they're still commonly called asters, but scientifically their names have changed.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not alone in being confused by them. I put myself in that category.
Yes.
As you may read in my book, Ezra Gray, who did the early treatment of asters, was befuddled by them at many points and almost willing to give up. But he pursued and eventually finished his research.
I think you excerpted a little note he wrote to someone else saying, you know, kind of, if you find me in the loony bin, it's because of the asters.
Right.
Trying to characterize. Well, I'm having a lot of fun with the book, and I'm so excited that, Carol, that it came out, Summer Wildflowers of the Northeast, A Natural History. I'm so glad that it came out right now because, and especially with so much time being spent at home this year, I can be outside with it and really look more closely thanks to your insights. So thank you so much for taking the time.
Programming and underwriting support from Garden Tool Company. Garden Tool Company's wide selection of heirloom quality tools for your gardening passion is backed by outstanding customer service, fast shipping, and ongoing support. GardenToolCompany.com. Programming and underwriting support from Brushwood Nursery. For more than 20 years, Brushwood Nursery has shipped the finest selection of clematis and other vines all over the United States with full gallon-sized plant and free shipping. Their website is full of beautiful pictures and information on growing clematis. BrushwoodNursery.com.
Thanks to all of you for listening, too. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version on Stitcher or iTunes, and you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or on Facebook and Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.